Hello. Welcome to Big Dating Energy. I am Jeff Gunther, licensed professional counselor. I'm so happy you're here with me today because I'm talking with Logan Urie. I've been a fan of Logan's for a while. I think she's been a fan of mine too. So it's really exciting to connect with her on this podcast episode. She wrote a book called How to Not Die Alone, The Surprising Science That Will Help You Find Love. It's basically your go-to guide for navigating the world of modern dating. She breaks down the science of relationships into super relatable advice, helping you figure out your dating style or how to make smarter choices in love, and ultimately how to find that special someone without feeling like you're just wandering around in the dark. I love her approach. It's all based on behavioral science and it's data backed and it's just incredibly practical. Every chapter that I read, I was able to take something from it and apply it to my dating life. So if you just sort of like want like this no bullshit guide and also like a compassionate encouragement to just like get the fuck out there and do it already. And here's a little bit of like a handbook that will make you feel more braver and aware of what you're looking for, then you should check out her book. When I came up with my book idea, the Big Dating Energy book, I first titled it How to Not Die Alone, which happens to be the same title as Logan's book. And I swear to you, I had no idea that she had written a book called How to Not Die Alone, but that must be wrong because I thought that was like such a great original title. And then when I was researching the title, I saw that she wrote that book and I was like, what the fuck? So very jealous of the title of her book. So I went from How to Not Date Alone to Date Great. That was the title of the book when I like wrote the book proposal with my co-author, Kate. And we were so happy with that. Two words, real short, rhymey, right? Date great. We love it. We sent it to the, you know, to our editor when we picked a publisher. And the editor was like, this isn't it, guys. Like, we need to not go with date great. Interestingly, though, and I'm not trying to, like, cause any drama, but I'm just going to put this out there. I'm not sure what happened. But in our book proposal, Date Great, we make a joke that our second book is going to be called Fight Right. And you know who wrote a book called Fight Right and released that like a few weeks ago? Is the Gottmans. What is going on there? Did they somehow steal our title for the second book that I was planning on writing or at least joking about writing? I don't know. I mean, that doesn't make sense, right? The Gottmans, what do they care about me, Therapy Jeff? They probably care a lot. I'm a pretty big deal. The thing is, here's my conspiracy theory. I wrote the book proposal, Date Great. Fight Right was in there. I sent that book proposal to like 10 different publishers. One of those publishers is the Gottmans publisher. They read the book proposal. Eventually, once the Gottmans wrote their new book, which is a great book called Fight Right, while they were trying to come up with titles for it, their publisher, who read my book proposal, possibly was just like, you know what is a great title? Fight Right. I don't know if that happened on purpose or subconsciously, or if that didn't happen at all and the Gottmans came up with it all on their own. I don't know. I'm just saying. Anyways, I really love my title. You know what? I kind of hope that like it causes a little bit of drama. Somehow this is going to attract the Gottmans onto my podcast, or maybe detract the Gottmans from coming on my podcast. I need to get them to come on the podcast and dig deeper into their Fight Right title, I think. I love that my book is called Big Dating Energy. That's a really great title. It was almost called Love in This Economy, which I think is better, but nobody else thought it was better. Anyways, I am talking to Logan. You are going to love her. She's going to give you so many great tips. I love our conversation. Here it is. Hello, Logan.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here with you. I feel like you have this great celeb status among my friends and people I work with at Hinge and my dating coaching clients. So I'm very, very happy to be here with you and just to get to know you a bit more.
Oh, thank you. Yes. And I am a big fan of yours. I read your book. It's very good. You're like so into the data and we love to see it.
Great.
Yeah. And I feel like the data like really grounds everybody when you're reading that book. So for people who don't know your work, what do they need to know about you?
Yeah. So a couple things. So I work at Hinge. I've worked there for almost 4 years as the director of relationship science. It's a really cool job where I get to be inside the data, as we talked about, doing research, understanding what's going on with Gen Z dating, what's going on with sober dating, kind of asking the questions, tracking culture, and seeing what happens from there. And I also work as a one-on-one dating coach, and I have classes that I teach. And so some of the things that people might know about me are I wrote this book called How to Not Die Alone. And mm-hmm. some of the main concepts there. So one of them is called the three dating tendencies. And this is a framework to understand what's holding you back from finding love. So for people who come to me for coaching and they're like, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, but things aren't working. I try to figure out where are they having trouble. And I came up with this framework that organizes people into these three types. And each type suffers from unrealistic expectations. And so the first type is the romanticizer, and they have unrealistic expectations of relationships. I'm sure you get messages from these people all the time where they're like, I want to find my soulmate. There's one person for life. I'll know it when I see it. If the relationship gets hard, it must not be for me. Mm-hmm. And so they really struggle with that. The next type mm-hmm. is the maximizer, and they have unrealistic expectations of their partner. So this is the one who's always trying to trade up, or I want to take the looks of this girl, plus the ambition of this girl, plus the family of this girl, and sort of Frankenstein my perfect person. And they're obsessed with the search. I need to keep searching and then I'll find my perfect person. Mm-hmm. And the last type is the hesitator, and they have unrealistic expectations of themselves. So for them, dating sounds like, oh, I can't put myself out there. I can't date because I'm not thin enough yet, or good looking enough yet, or I haven't read this book or done enough therapy. And so there's always this moving goalpost that explains why they can't start dating yet. And they are really hard on themselves. A lot of it is around self-esteem and self-love, where they feel like they're just not eligible to date yet. And they need to make all these changes to themselves. And then one day in the future, they'll be quote unquote 100% ready to date.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like where do you feel like these things come from? Do they come from like society, family, Hollywood, online, like social media, or all of the above?
I think all of the above. Plus, I think sometimes people are just wired a certain way. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like living in the Bay Area, working in tech for many years, you do see a lot of maximizers. It's sort of just like a way of looking at the world. Like, for example, Black Friday was recently, and I was doing a lot of research on wire cutter. Oh, you know, what's the best wireless headphones? Or looking on the Strategist. Mm-hmm. What are the warmest winter gloves that you can use your phone while wearing them? And there's kind of this feeling in our culture of like, I can just research my way to the right answer. And mm-hmm. if you apply that to dating, of course, what you think is, oh, I'll just keep researching and researching and eventually find the right person. So I think the maximizer does come from culture. I think with the romanticizer, definitely comes from feelings of maybe from social media or rom-coms, like, oh, everyone has this perfect relationship. I watched a lot of Hallmark movies, and now I need to find my, you know, cute cowboy that somehow hasn't been snatched up yet. Right. And then for the hesitator, I think a lot of that is very internal, and a feeling of, I'm not good enough. Who would love me? Why would I put myself out there right now and risk somebody great rejecting me? And so I think a lot of that is an internal feeling of insecurity and not being good enough. And so I think that similar to attachment theory, there's probably has to do with the way that you were raised, genetics, and then also the societal messages that you picked up.
Sure. Yeah. And sometimes, like when I was reading the book and I was reading about these tendencies and other things that you wrote about, you're just sort of like, I feel like you're shining a light on these things, which is something that we do in therapy, right? We just sort of like shine a light on the things that maybe we don't know is happening, and just illuminating it can make you have like a different relationship with it. Or now you have like a deliberate choice of whether or not this is working for you or it's not working for you. Is that what you typically do like with your coaching clients? You're like, oh, okay, you're fitting into like this sort of category or box, and then asking them to behave differently? Or are you like kind of digging in to try to figure out how it maybe served them in the past, but isn't serving them now?
Yeah, great question. So I would say I love how you talked about shining a light because that definitely resonates with me. My background is in behavioral science, so the study of how people make decisions. And one of the key ideas in behavioral science is that we often act irrationally. So we often act against our own best interests. And so it's really saying, well, people are irrational, but in these predictable ways, and how can we use that information to understand it? And so I've taken the lessons from behavioral science and applied them to dating. And that's where so many people get tripped up. So I think about relationships as a series of decisions. Am I ready to date? Who should I date? Should I see this person again? Should we DTR? Should we move in together? Should we get married? Should we break up? All of these things. And at each step, you can make a good decision and propel yourself into this great relationship, or you can make an ill-informed decision and hold yourself back or get into a bad relationship. And so at each step, what's going on with people's decision-making? That's really how I think about it. I think about it really as this journey or as this line, and I try to dig in, where are they having trouble? And when you said shine a light, why I really liked that is because I like to think about them as blind spots. If everyone knew, oh, I know exactly what my problem is, I can fix it, then I wouldn't have a job and maybe you wouldn't be as popular as you are, right? So obviously this stuff is hard for people. And so oftentimes with coaching, people come to me and they're like, oh, I know exactly who I need to be with. Here's a spreadsheet of the people I've dated. I just need to find someone with these qualities. Help me find them. And I'm like, I don't think that's the main problem. Yes, of course, you need to find someone great, but you've actually dated a bunch of people who are similar to what you're looking for. You've had these situations. There's something else going on, whether it's how you're showing up, how people are evaluating you, how you're evaluating people, and kind of helping them understand what you think is the problem is often not the problem. What you think your type is often different than the type that's going to make you happiest long term. And so the work that I'm doing with them is uncovering what are the hidden patterns, what are the things holding them back from finding love. And that's the beginning. And then from there, what are the strategies, what are the tools that we can use to shift their behavior? And of course, both parts are hard, but maybe that second part is even harder because shifting human behavior is really, really challenging. Like, there's a reason why people know that they should work out and they don't, or know that they should eat healthier, or they don't, know that they should save money and they don't, right? We consistently act against our own best interests in dating and in other areas of life. And so I really try to go deep with people, identifying their patterns and then shifting that behavior.
Yeah, I love how you shine the light. And then it all feels like very good, practical advice of like, here's what you're doing. This is why it's not working. Do you want to think about doing it differently or thinking and behaving differently? Is there like a thread though for those folks who can understand what you're saying, but still choose to not date differently or make behavioral changes? Like, who are those folks who can't do it? Is there some common theme for them, or is it just sort of all over the place and random?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, maybe my answer would just have to do with a theory of behavior change in general. It's like there are some people that will not change and they are either going to give up or get the same results over and over again, or maybe be in a bad relationship, or maybe they'll change on their own. And so it's like, I think about the title of my book, right? How to Not Die Alone. To me, it's really funny. It's really my sense of humor. Like, I'm really into comedy. I'm into humor. I like kind of being a little edgy in that sense. So to me, it makes me laugh. I have had interviews where people are like, you're saying that everyone needs to be in a relationship. You're saying that it's, if you die alone, it's a problem. I'm like, no, if there was a book called How to Create French Cooking, that book doesn't mean the only cooking that's acceptable is French cooking. It's like, if you're interested in French cooking, buy this book. For me, it's like, if you're interested in not dying alone, buy this book. And so my work is available to people who like the data, like research-backed, want insights to change their behavior, and are willing to do something different. If somebody came to me but wasn't willing to change their behavior, do something different, I'd say we're probably not the right fit because I'm not here to enable you. I'm really not here to be your cheerleader or your friend. I'm here to be your coach and help you shift. And so, of course, there's going to be people that are not picking up what I'm putting down, but luckily enough, people are. And I think even just last night, I had a 6-week check-in for my class that I taught in October. And people were talking about some of their wins and some of their challenges. And so somebody talked about a win. She's like, I haven't found a boyfriend yet, but I ran in the other direction from red flags with an avoidant guy. I was like, great. That is a great win. And yes. Somebody else was saying, hey, I'm doing everything you told me to do, but I'm still not getting a lot of matches. And then we tried to troubleshoot that. And so I think the point is that by the time people are coming to work with me, they've had a lot of frustration. It's not like they're like, I'm new to dating. Like, let's go pay Logan some money. It's like, no, like I've tried things. It's not working. And so I think when people come to me, they're like, I've done things my way. I'm willing to try things your way. Let's see if that makes a difference.
Sure. Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So I feel like people are like going to, and hypothetically, at least they're ready to make change. They want to make change. They're frustrated with how things are going and they're looking to you for some guidance and maybe like a fresh look on how they can set up a profile or behave online or when they're meeting up with dates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it makes me think of a client I had recently where I felt like she mostly just wanted to talk and sort of talk theoretically about things, but then she wasn't actually dating. And I was like, okay, like we've had two calls. Like I really need you going out on some dates. Like what is one small step you can do before we meet again to get you to date? And she was like, what if I write 3 blog posts about the Gottman Institute and bids? And I was like, no, nobody needs you to write that blog post. I need you to start dating. I can't just, you know, we're not here to do like a philosophy class. I'm here to help you get to the next step. So I was like, we cannot meet again until you go on one date, and sort of using like our coaching as an incentive to get her to go out. And that did work for her. But it's really like, I'm so invested in these people changing. I'm not invested in just talking about dating. And anyway, I just thought that example was funny because I was like, why are we here? You know, this isn't like a class on dating. This is really like for you to start dating.
Yeah. No, it's a common question that I'll have with my clients is like, you know, we've been talking about the same thing for weeks now. Mm-hmm. Are you getting what you need out of these therapy sessions? What was the goal in the first place? Do you feel like you've moved towards that goal? And I want them to get their money and their time's worth, right? So
I love that. Somebody told me something recently that their therapist said to them or their coach said to them, which was like, okay, so this woman had some like annoying roommate or annoying neighbor or something like that. And she's like, my time with you is expensive. And we've now spent 3 sessions on this person. Do you want to spend a 4th session on this person? Is this person worth like X number of dollars? And I think sometimes bringing up the fact that like, hey, you're here for yourself. Is this how you want to spend our precious time together? And just kind of having that meta conversation. I think that's actually like a form of respect to the client and a helpful way of being like, no, that person is totally not worth 4 sessions. And I need to either accept it or make a change. But I don't want to, we don't need to talk about it again.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And there's something like, maybe subconscious or unconscious going on where they would rather just stay stuck and not make any big changes because making changes feels risky or vulnerable or you could be hurt or something like that. So putting it in that way of like, do you want to spend your time and money on that sort of like, yeah, rocks the boat just enough sometimes.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It's like most people don't change. Why do most people not change? Because change is hard. Change is scary. Change requires creating new neural pathways. Change requires potentially, if you try and you fail, that's more embarrassing than if you didn't try at all. I think all of that is true. And that's why when people work with me, I'm really proud of them. I'm like, great, you took a hard step of being here and let's make this worth your time and money.
Yeah, exactly. You've talked about, and I've talked about too, how maybe we should like not take the spark so seriously and maybe just sort of like fuck the spark. Can you talk more about that and what your views are on the spark?
Yeah, it's fun because I know that you've written a book that's coming out next summer. Yes. And when you write a book, well, it might be a little different for you because you have your TikTok audience and you maybe know what resonates and doesn't. I didn't have that experience. So for me, it's like you write this book, you have a number of chapters, you don't necessarily know like what's going to pop off or not. But this fuck the spark thing really has taken on a life of its own. And I think it's a fun little tagline. And so the main thing behind it is that I was working with all these clients who would go on great dates with great people and then say, I'm not going to see that person again. And I would say, why not? And they would say, I just didn't feel the spark. And it became this all-encompassing idea of if somebody didn't feel instant chemistry, instant, I want to rip your clothes off, then they didn't want to see that person again. And I tried to demystify that. And so the main idea is that, yes, the spark feels great. When I've had the spark with people, I'm like, oh, like I could talk to this person for hours. The time passes. It's really exciting. It's a great feeling. I'm not saying that the spark isn't wonderful. I'm saying that it's not a prerequisite for a great relationship. And so the three myths of the spark are, one, that if you don't feel the spark, then nothing can develop over time. And that's absolutely not true. We know that only 11% of couples experience love at first sight. And many people end up with their neighbor or somebody at work. And that's because it grew over time. And so the key idea here is, if you have no interest in them at all, you're not going to go from 0 to 100. But if you're in the middle, then that can grow. And that is something that you should foster. Mm-hmm. The second myth is that if you feel the spark, it's necessarily a good thing. And we absolutely know that that's not true. Some people are just really sparky. They give that feeling to everyone. Mm-hmm. They are really hot. They might even be narcissistic. There might be something about them that's actually triggering that feeling in you. And you think it's positive, but it's actually something negative. And so lots of people feel the spark with someone and it fizzles. And then the third thing is, oh, well, if the relationship starts out with a spark, then there's long-term potential. And that's also not true. A lot of couples had that amazing spark and then are still in a relationship that doesn't serve them because they're chasing that initial attraction that has fizzled and they didn't have the great foundation. And so instead of the spark and being obsessed with instant chemistry, I really help people go after the slow burn. I married a slow burn. This is so cheesy, but it is true. So I've been with my husband for almost 9 years. And I actually think our relationship like this month is better than it's ever been. And I'm like, I didn't really know that that was possible, but he has gotten really into meditation. He just came back from a silent retreat. He's super present right now. And like, we're just having so much fun and it's great. And I'm like, this really is a slow burn person. I knew him for 7 or 8 years before we started dating. We're friends for a full year and then started dating. And I really feel like our relationship's getting deeper and deeper. And I've dated and been attracted to super sparky people in the past. And then it didn't work out. And instead, I feel like this is someone where they get better over time, and who wouldn't want to be with someone where year 9 is better than year 1?
Yeah, for sure. I feel like the sparky people that you maybe dated before you met your husband, where do you think that spark was coming from? Because I feel like sometimes we can be we can feel the chemistry with somebody because we're like, oh my God, they're so hot, I'm so attracted to them, or they're so smart, or they're so incredibly funny. For you personally, where did the spark come from? And is it the same place that it comes from in your current relationship with your husband, or is it a different sort of place?
Yeah, I think that I really love the way you phrase the question, and I think it's very intuitive. Let's see. I feel like going back to college and maybe early working, you might just see someone and be really physically attracted to them. So there's like that first piece of physical attraction where I'm trying to imagine like you're in a class with somebody and you see them in the lecture hall and you're like, oh, who's that guy? Like he's really cute. So there's, I think there's that first feeling and then you kind of get excited about them. And then when you talk, maybe they open their mouths and you're like, okay, not for me, or it develops even more. And then, you know, maybe you start texting. Like I think just that feeling of initial, I'm attracted to you, I feel like sexually drawn to you, and is there more? I think like that's one common way. I like that you brought up intelligence because I'm sure that I had that before in a social group or at work where maybe you're at dinner with someone and they're extremely charismatic or they're telling really interesting stories. Or I think for me, I've always been really drawn to people that are really good at projects. Like, oh, wow, like that person has such a cool life outside of work. Like whether it's they are really into their Burning Man camp and they have this big art project or just like this really cool community service project, like something about like they have a full life and they're good at planning and really like manifesting and creating the life they want. I was always drawn to that. And then I think the last piece that I absolutely can't ignore is sort of the anxious avoidant loop and feeling like, oh, well, I like this person, but they're a little mean to me or they're a little hard to get, or, you know, sometimes they're hot and sometimes they're cold, and that really revving up my engine. And I think a lot of people experience that. And so I didn't have the language for it at the time, but I think the feeling of somebody who's interested, but only sometimes, makes us feel really excited. And one of the things that I teach in my class is about this idea of a different reward schedule. So when you get a consistent reward over time, you expect that reward and it's not that exciting. When mm-hmm. you have kind of the Las Vegas style where it's like, all right, I'm going to see what happens when I put this coin in, like, is the thing I want going to come out or not? And you're at the slot machines, that feeling of an unknown reward is very exciting. And so when people would give me an unknown reward, hot or cold, interested or not, I think that really got me excited. And I would pursue those people and really fall for them, even if they weren't actually that great or that nice to me, or right. they didn't bring out a good side of me. And so I think a combination of like looks, charisma, seeming to have a very full life, and then finally kind of just triggering my anxious mm-hmm. attachment.
Mm-hmm. And did your... what kind of spark do you have, those sorts of sparks in your current relationship, or is it a completely different sort of like healthy spark that isn't yeah. based on those?
You know,
things?
I've thought about this, and sometimes I'm like, can I even be honest about how I felt in the beginning? Because it's almost become so like mythologized in my work. Like, does anyone really have an accurate view of how they met their partner this yeah, many no. years ago? So there's a part of me that kind of almost like doubts my own memory. But mm-hmm. my, you know, so we first met in college, and then 7 or 8 years ago, he came up to me at the Google shuttle and was like, oh, didn't you go to Harvard and date this person? And we were kind of reconnected. And then we had this lunch together. And I do remember feeling a version of the spark at the lunch where I just felt like, oh, when this person talks, I like feel drawn to them and I want to spend more time with them. And we easily could have never seen each other again or like not made plans. I mean, Google's such a big company. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned, oh, I'm trying to learn this statistical programming language. And he was like, I just dropped out of a PhD where I learned that I can tutor you in it. And so he reached out to me and set up some time for him to tutor me. And like, now that I know him, that's actually very out of character for him. So I think he must have felt something, but it's so, yeah. you know, I basically just saying I'm doubting my own memory because it's a long time ago and sure. now we have this love story, but he did something out of character. So I would say I did feel drawn to him, but we didn't start dating for a year after that. I was dating right. a bunch of other people. I fell for this guy at Burning Man. So it was like, there was enough there to keep in touch and to develop mm-hmm. a stronger friendship, but it wasn't like, holy shit, we need to go on a date this weekend. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a number of factors that explain why it took a while for me to see him in a new light. Mm-hmm. And I think he's also the kind of person where it makes sense to me knowing him that like I sort of took the lead and then he followed.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's, I feel like that's a really good definition or story about like more of a slow burn, which you typically, which you talk about in, you know, when you're talking about the spark. There's, it's tricky. I think you're right. Like we're all kind of like, whether we're aware of it or not, we're like seeking that spark and looking for that chemistry. And like you're saying, sometimes it can come from just like, oh, I'm really physically attracted to this person, or they make me laugh, or they have this charisma, or it can like go into either your attachment style and the dynamic that comes up there, or it can go into like, I grew up and developed abandonment issues, and the person that I'm like with right now feels like they're going to heal that, but really, in fact, they're actually going to like trigger that even more. Like they're so, the spark is so complicated, and I feel like going like just sort of being present with it, witnessing the spark, and trying not to like take it too seriously is sort of the way to go. And maybe even thinking like, okay, this is, it might not be a red flag that there's a spark, but it's a orange flag possibly. Like it's something to keep an eye on and maybe isn't something that I should completely trust.
I love everything you're saying. And I think even the language that you're using around witnessing it feels very advanced and thoughtful in a way that's aspirational. And I think people should sure. do that. And if it almost feels too loaded to do it in a romantic context, can people do it in a friendship context? So let's say that I'm at a dinner with some friends and some people I don't know, and there's a person that I can feel kind of repulsed by, like, or repelled by, maybe repulsed is too strong. And I'm like, I'm not enjoying talking to this person. Like, what is going on? Is it actually that they're too similar to me and that I feel threatened by them and they're playing the role that I play in this friend group? is it that their communication style isn't my preferred way of being asked questions? Am I just in a bad mood? Is it that I really wanted to talk to my friend who's here and this person wants to talk to me? Like, just kind of being aware of like, what's my reaction to this person and why? And because friendship feels less loaded than romantic relationships, because obviously for people in monogamous partnerships, you get to choose one. Whereas with friendships, you can have many different types. Right. And then just paying attention to like, oh, who at the dinner did I feel drawn to and why? And just starting to pay attention to what environments, what people, what dynamics are light you up and which kind of make you feel smaller. I think if people can work on that as a muscle, they will be so much better at dating.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, I think that's a really good way of looking at it for sure. Because we do, like you're saying, there is like feelings of spark or chemistry or some sort of like energetic feeling that you get when you meet people, whether it's coworkers or friends or whoever. So understanding like who you're magnetized to or repelled by is always really good info.
Yeah. And one more reason why I think that's important is that, so kind of another thing from my book that has taken off is this idea of the post-date eight. And these are eight questions to ask yourself after a date to see if you should see the person again. And the thought behind that is that we're often asking the wrong questions. We're asking either, are they good enough for me? Or did they like me? Or are they good on paper? Things that are not correlated with long-term relationship success. And instead, these questions help you really focus on things like, what side of me did they bring out? Did I feel more energized or de-energized? Did I feel captivated, bored, somewhere in between? Did I feel curious about them? And then the point is to see, oh, maybe I didn't feel the craziest spark, but I felt some interest and I should see them again. Or I didn't feel interested at all. Or actually, they made me feel bad. And it helps you tune into all of that. And so I feel like I've worked with a bunch of clients that will say, oh, well, they're so good on paper and they keep seeing them. I'm like, but they treat you really poorly and you seem less confident than you did when I met you. How can I help you understand that this person isn't creating the right dynamic for you? And so helping people get out of that checklist mindset or that good on paper mindset.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think that there's like, do you think that dating currently in our modern times is harder than before? Or do you think it's easier? Or is it harder and easier in different ways?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. And I think the harder reasons are pretty obvious. I think the paradox of choice around having so many options really does get to people. Like, people become more disposable. If I can go on a date with you and then know that if I screw things up, I can just go on an app and find someone else, I'm treating you with less respect and humanity than I would before. I think that that is a real thing that happens. I think that there's a lot of pressure on people to make this big decision. Like, we're being told from, you know, whether it's romantic comedies or business leaders or psychologists, everyone is saying this is the most important decision of your life. I think that creates a lot of pressure.
Sure.
If you look at the history of marriage, people now expect way more from their partners than they did in the past. So, you know, it used to be just safety and security. Then it was love. Now it's, I need to self-actualize in my relationship. And if you don't help me play the guitar, which you knew I wanted to learn the guitar, then like, I need to break up with you because you're not helping me embrace my musical talent. I really think our expectations are so high. And so those are things that make dating harder. But then I also feel like, look around, like, where are people meeting? People are meeting right now on apps. This has been true since 2017, that the majority of couples the majority of couples meet on an app, and it used to be at work, through friends, at bars, and now dating apps since 2017 have been the number one ways that couples meet. And I think that that cannot be overestimated, because if you are in the LGBTQ plus community and there wasn't a gay bar in your community, it was hard to know who's single, who's queer, who might be interested in me. And the apps have really just made that so much easier. And the same thing goes if you're 55 plus, if you live in a rural community, there's all these ways in which connections that never would have happened are happening, because dating apps are just really good at making these matches, connecting people, and helping people who had no shared context meet.
Right. Yeah. It's the part where you're talking about, like, it's really tricky to not just get back on that sort of carousel of dating apps and swiping and knowing that there could possibly be a better match for you out there. Do you think that there's always a better match for you out there, and eventually you're just going to have to kind of like stick with the person who's good enough? Is that like something that you talk to your coaching clients about?
Yeah. So I think because of the way that I'm wired, the way that I speak, living in Silicon Valley, I do attract a lot of those maximizers. And by the way, mm-hmm. if people are like listening to this being like, what type am I? They can take the quiz on my website. So I do work with many maximizers. And mm-hmm. I think for the maximizers, such a big part of what we work on is they think if I keep on searching, I will find the perfect person. I don't want to give up my search. And my feeling is there are many people with whom you could have a great relationship. Each of them has a set of problems. You get to choose the set of problems you're willing to deal with, but nobody's perfect. And at a certain point, you have to choose the person, build the relationship, and make it work. And that's very hard for them because they feel like I'm saying give up, or it's against their philosophy of, you know, finding the perfect thing. And so a lot of it is very psychological. It's what's the difference between the perfect choice or the right choice? What's the difference between making the optimal decision versus feeling good about your decision? And so a lot of it, and I'm sure you do the same in your practice, is really thinking about how to say to somebody, there's no such thing as anyone. There's no such thing as a perfect partner. You've dated a lot of people. You've seen who's out there. Now let's find somebody great who has the qualities you're looking for and build that relationship with them.
Yeah, there's a lot of grief work there, I feel like, that I talk to my clients about. So if you're looking for a relationship and maybe just a monogamous relationship, choosing one person, saying yes to that person means saying no to everybody else, like the rest of the world. And that feels like a huge decision to make. There's also, I don't know if this is something that you notice, but there's something, and maybe if I'm going to be like a little gendered about it, this might be more happening to men, but I feel like there's also this decision or this thing that you have to go through where you're just like, I'm going to grieve my youth. So a lot of people feel like dating around and being on dating apps like is very youthful, and you are like really, you're sort of like doing it as fun and exciting and a little chaotic, but like uncertain and who knows what's going to happen. And this all feels very young and fun and youthful. And then when you decide to like, quote unquote, settle down with somebody, that means that like they might look at that as like, now I'm becoming an adult and I'm going to have to say goodbye to like this youthful energy that I've been cultivating through the dating scene. So not only is it saying yes to this person means saying no to everybody else, but it's also like I'm stepping into the next developmental stage, which feels really fucking boring, or which isn't as exciting. And they might even be making the choice that like dating and being youthful feels passionate, also maybe a little bit chaotic. And they have to eventually be like, I'm not going to choose excitement and chaos, and instead I'm going to choose harmony and balance, where that's what I'm going to try to cultivate with my like one person. So this is like a huge, like big life decision that I feel like the dating apps and our culture make it harder to like make that choice. Do you get that sense?
I hadn't thought about that before, but everything you're saying makes a lot of sense. And it really, I think, speaks to the clients that I work with who are late 30s, early 40s, where they're great catches, people are interested in them. And there's just kind of this feeling that they have about themselves, people have about them, I have about them, which is like, why are you still single? Why hasn't this worked out yet? And there's not an obvious reason why. And I think what you're suggesting, which is that the choice to enter a relationship means giving up part of their identity that they really value around youthfulness or fun or passion or novelty, right, and that it's really hard for them to make that shift. And I definitely have seen that in the people I work with. And I think it's a really smart point.
Yeah. I think, you know, and it might be like, I'm looking at that or they're looking at that in too black and white sort of way. Like you can still be, you know, have a lot of excitement and right, passion and novelty while also being in long-term relationships.
Right. It's less about whether that's realistic and more about whether that's their assumption.
Yes.
And so it's like somebody going from renting to owning a house. It's like, well, when you're a homeowner, you have to do all these annoying things. It's like, yes, that's true. But you know, you might want to paint the walls. This isn't that. It's like somebody kind of has to own that it is a transition, but that they can still maintain a lot of the other parts of life mm-hmm. in that relationship. And I also think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing a rise in non-monogamy is that, you know, people love this NRE, new relationship energy, and they get really excited about meeting someone new and they want to keep having that feeling, or they love flirting and hooking up with people. Like, can they have the relationship that they want and also keep some of that? And so people are obviously navigating and negotiating new ways of being in relationships.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. there's also just sort of like this focus, like there's always been, I guess, like on being youthful, being young, still like having that energy, and wanting to, and feeling like life is limitless or something, when like being maybe like grieving some of that youth and picking a person to be with long-term, if that's what your goal is, you can feel like really satisfied and proud of yourself, and look at you, you're like, you're making these like really mature adult decisions. We love to see it.
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely want to think about this more, but my gut is that we're living in a particularly youth obsessed time, mm-hmm. with plastic surgery and filters and all of the ways that people are appearing younger. And I think probably different cultures right now and our culture in the past have had more respect for wisdom, aging, the right. elderly, all of those things. And so if you are in a culture that's really prizing youth culture and youth appearance, then it's even harder to make the transition. Whereas if you're in a culture that's like, the point of life is obligation and family and connection, then you probably don't have as much resistance to settling down with someone.
Yeah, for sure. I wonder if also if it's like, you know, sometimes we equate being an adult with like buying a house or having a mm-hmm. big savings account or something. And now it's like harder to actually do those goals because mm-hmm. of whatever, capitalism yeah, yeah. or inflation or all this stuff. And so we're sort of like feeling more youthful because we're not yeah. like hitting those goals that we were told were set up for us. And that's what maturity looks like or something. So we're just like fucking around and trying to like stay young. But yeah, it's a good, like, you know, plastic surgery, all the stuff.
Yeah, I think that's true. I have done a ton of research into Gen Z dating. And one of the things that kept coming up was they're like, I don't have a 9-to-5 job. I have like 10 different jobs that all feel really stressful. I never feel like I'm off. I can't make plans for after work because I might have to be doing one of my multiple side hustles or driving for Uber or whatever it is. And they're like, it takes a certain amount of time to build the foundation of friendships or romantic relationships. And I feel too stressed by the lack of a social net to even do that. And so obviously this stuff is really complicated, but it is interesting to think about, if you don't sort of feel settled in other ways, do you feel like you can get a partner and be a partner?
Yeah. Yeah. No, these are really good questions. I don't know. There's sort of like shifting a little bit, but maybe like along these lines, I feel like something that's been trending maybe, you know, for a little bit, but especially during the pandemic when we were all sort of like having a mental health crisis. And it was also when like my like therapy shit started to like get a lot of views and I started to create a bigger following, because there was like, we were all started to sort of like focus on mental health and therapy. And there is a shift in how we look at therapy in society, where it was like more valued. The stigma was not as much. I think that's partly because of like, I don't know if you noticed this, but I feel like it's partly because of like big therapy, like the big therapy apps in Silicon Valley.
And their ads.
And their ads are fucking amazing. Like,
you like their ads?
No, but I think that they're like very savvy marketers. And what they totally. Did was they shifted like stigma and mental health stigma so dramatically that it made like so many more people open to therapy. And there was also like me and other content creators that like are talking about therapy more often. But I think we actually rode those coattails of big therapy, not even knowing, because Silicon Valley big therapy was like, oh, I think we can make money off of therapy. And so let's go ahead and like change it. So like, yay that they've like made this shift, but also like it's because of capitalism, maybe, whatever, it's complicated. But because of that, I feel like there was also like, men are more open to going to therapy, and women are also like looking for men maybe on dating apps that are talking about going to therapy, that are maybe like forcing or encouraging men to be a little bit more or a lot more like emotionally intelligent. And like, I've gotten this weird feedback from men. Now, there's only like 10 to 15% of my followers are men on TikTok and Instagram. Yeah, it's interesting. It's just more like, here's women doing all the emotional labor, probably. Mm-hmm. Like, this just sort of like, that makes sense and is unfortunate or sad. But the feedback or the like direct messages I get from men is just like, what you're doing therapy, Jeff, is you're making it harder for us to be like attractive to women. Like the bar is almost like too high for men, while women are sometimes complaining that like the bar is still on the fucking floor for men.
What do they mean by that? Like, what's an example of something that you're putting out there that's making stuff harder for them?
Yeah, I'm saying that like, I'm first of all, like valuing emotional sensitivity and intelligence, yeah, and asking for needs to be met and having check-ins and making sure that you find somebody who can like hold emotional space for you, who can validate and reassure you. Like that shit isn't needy and unattractive. That's just like good communication. Mm-hmm. And you should find a partner. And since my audience is predominantly women, I'm saying like you should find a man, mm-hmm, maybe that is like that can hold that space, mm-hmm, that can meet you at that level.
Got it.
And so then I get this like weird feedback that like this is not how like men have been socialized. Understandably, I wasn't socialized that way. I was a kid in the 80s and 90s, and I did not have like any emotional intelligence. And that was what I thought was like fucking hot. I thought that was really attractive. Like, I'm just going to be a man, mm-hmm, slash toxically masculine in a, mm-hmm, way. And now like things have shifted, and hopefully like I've helped them to shift a little bit. And some men are getting left behind. And those are maybe the men that are kind of like becoming whatever, incels, or they're, mm-hmm, getting like really mad at women. I don't know. This is a really big conversation maybe, but do you think like in general, do you think that like it's moving in a good direction and men are keeping up? Do you think that like the bar is lower or higher? What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much there, and I genuinely am so interested in your experience because I don't get those messages, and I'm, okay, curious like how I would respond. Like what do you respond at all? What do you say to them?
Well, I used to respond. So sometimes I'll get an angry message where, okay, I'm like, where some guy will email me. They like to email me. They don't direct message me. Or they're just like, where's your fucking email, guy? Because I have something to say to you.
Oh my gosh. I also get the craziest emails.
Yeah. So the emails are like, it's because of you that my girlfriend broke up with me. It's because of your shitty like content.
Yes, it's your fault. It's my fault.
Yes, because they don't want to take responsibility themselves.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for me and for all the other content creators like us that are telling, you know, men to step up or something.
Wow.
And it's interesting because like I do also mostly like in person, if I run into somebody that recognizes me, a woman will come up to me and they'll be like, it's because of you that I broke up with my boyfriend. So it's not happening. Like that is a thing that's happening.
Okay,
that some of these women are breaking up with these men.
What an interesting position you find yourself in.
Yeah. So there's like, I feel good that these like women are like, thank you. I don't know how I feel about these men that are sort of like mad or attacking me. And yeah, I was wondering if you have any of the same experience.
Sorry that I keep asking. I mean, I'm just so
interested. Keep on asking the questions.
But I imagine that, okay, if I'm thinking about my own journey of getting these types, not this strand of email, but kind of emails from people that are a little tacky over the years and how my position has changed. I imagine in the beginning you might be like, hey, like here's a perspective on why this might be useful to you. Or like, it sounds like your girlfriend learned information that empowered her and then she made a decision. Like you might want to think about why she wasn't getting what she needed. And if you want to do it in the future, then I imagine you didn't get good responses and you no longer respond.
Right. Yeah. A lot of times the responses from these guys don't come from like a curious place, right? They come, mm-hmm, from like an angry place. And yeah. I want to like figure out how to like hold space for them or talk to them, mm-hmm, or connect with them or something and encourage them to do the emotional work,
yeah,
and also like hold compassion,
yeah,
for them because they were raised in societies or environments or families,
right,
that didn't value this. And now they're like, oh, all these women are asking so much from me emotionally. What the fuck?
Have you ever put out a video about that?
No, I don't think I
have. Because I'm really like so fascinated by what you're saying. And like, I would listen, yeah, to a couple of videos, uh-huh, about it. I could imagine you putting something out there that's like, hey, this is something that I've been experiencing. It's very interesting to me because I'm basically part of a movement to raise the bar. But in raising the bar, people are getting broken up with and are frustrated. Here's why I will continue to talk about this. And here's my message to men who are experiencing this. And then when you get those emails, you could send it to them and be like, I've put a lot of thought into this. Here's a video, take it or leave it. Because it is a learning moment. It is a chance for that person to be like, wow, I want to be with these great women that are holding themselves in high regard. And part of that is how they want to be treated. And maybe I should look in the mirror and think about it. And maybe they'll say F you and kind of ignore it. But like, I actually just do think what you're talking about is really interesting. And it reminds me of, do you know Scott Galloway? Is he someone that you're into?
No.
He's cool. He's a marketing professor at NYU. He's on a really popular business podcast called Pivot. He's a very successful entrepreneur. And his big thing right now is masculinity. And so he just has like a ton of great research on, you know, the crisis of men and what's happening with young males and everything from like the incel community to just, you know, 2/3 of college graduates are women. He's just really exploring the dynamics of that. And I feel like he's coming at it from a really great kind of older guy place of like, hey, like masculinity includes vulnerability. And like when you see a football player who just lost a big game, like jumping into his mom's arms in his uniform, because that was really hard, like that moves masculinity forward, not backwards. And so I would say the topic in general is really interesting. And you are kind of playing this interesting role of speaking to majority women, hearing from men, and like, what can you do to shift the culture around that? So anyway, I think that's very cool that you're finding yourself in that place.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I probably need to like lean into that place a lot more, just kind of like explore and see what I can do there. There's like, have you seen, I don't know, videos or content about like, this is what's wrong with modern women today. They're too independent. They're asking for too much. They have like too much going on in their lives and they're not like creating space for us men. It's yeah.
I haven't seen a ton of videos on that, but like I had an experience where I was at the Comedy Cellar in New York. And this comedian, I ended up talking to this, like this comedian's content, like his comedy was like pretty neutral. And then I spoke to him afterwards. He was like outside and it turned out he was saying some stuff that was like a little problematic, but he was kind of going that direction of like, well, I dated this woman and she was a lawyer and she spent all her time with high powered men. So I wasn't good enough for her. So I had to break up with her because she was too high powered. I'm like, sounds like those were your issues, not her issues. But yeah, so I definitely like am aware of that sentiment. I don't think I'm being fed that content. But
yeah,
I think there's a lot of stuff out there where people are like, why are we having such a hard time matching? And then they try to bring it up to a level and say like, what are women doing wrong? What are men doing wrong? I tend not to play in those super gendered spaces. And I truly work with a lot of men and women. My book is purposely not like, hey, ladies, or like, hey, guys. I really try to think about the psychological piece. But like, of course, I think many of us have had that feeling of, I know so many great single women. Why aren't they finding anyone? And just sort of thinking like, what's going on in the market? What's going on in this pool? That I truly do feel like I know a lot of like really, really amazing women in their late 30s that are having a hard time. And I wish there were more people to set them up with.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. And sort of along the same lines, there's I mean, along the same lines of maybe like ending relationships or breakups, I get a lot of questions from my audience about like, I've been in this relationship for too long, so long to the point where like, I know that I don't want to be in it anymore. I want to end the relationship and I just don't know what to do and how to do it. And I feel really stuck in this relationship. I even get the question. There was like a business idea that I had in grad school where I thought that it would be a really great service. And people sometimes ask me for the service of just like, if you're in a relationship and you want to break up and you don't know how to do it or you're too scared, like you can hire me and I'll break up with your partner for you. And I will also sit with them and do counseling for them. I'll even somehow turn it into like a matchmaking service where like now I have all of the single people who are newly single and want to get into a relationship again. But it's those folks that are like in relationships, want to break up and feel really stuck. Do you have any specific advice for those people?
Yeah, this is something I've thought about a lot. And a few years ago when I was a resident at TED, so kind of doing research and then giving a TED talk, I focused on breakups. And so I just did tons of conversations with people who were basically in that mode of, I think I want to break up. How do I decide if I should break up? Should I break up? And what are the consequences? So I absolutely have done a lot of research there and thought about it. It also reminds me of what you said earlier, which is that these men come to you and are like, you're the reason why my girlfriend broke up with me. I'm not getting those emails, but I could be because I do a lot of breakup consulting where somebody comes to me and basically we have maybe like a 90-minute long conversation where they lay out, here's what's going on in the relationship. Here's kind of the stuff about me you need to know. Here's why I'm considering a breakup. What should I do? And I try to be a mirror or just a conversational partner to help them figure out, is this something about you that you could fix? Is this something about them that you could give them feedback on? Or is this a fundamental incompatibility that you need to get out of the relationship? So I'm passionate about this area and I've thought about it a lot. One contribution that I've made is this question called the wardrobe test question, which is something that I ask people on these calls where I say, okay, gut reaction. If your partner were a piece of clothing in your closet, something that you own, what piece of clothing would they be and why? Or they don't even have to say why, just what piece of clothing would they be? So for you, you know, you might say, it's my favorite black hoodie. And we would say, okay, you know, you always, when you're getting dressed, you grab it. You've worn it to your favorite shows. You feel comfortable in it. It represents how you want to put yourself in the world. You might be like, oh, it's these really nice boots that I bought, but actually pinch my toes and are uncomfortable and I end up not wearing them. And then we would analyze what that means. And I think just the absurdity of the question makes it fun to see how are you really feeling about this person? And that's sometimes where I start. But a lot of the conversation is about, can you give them feedback? Can you change, et cetera? For people who know they want to break up with the person, I have a whole chapter in my book about it. And it basically applies research from the field of goal setting to breaking up. So it's like, how do you set a goal and achieve it? And then if your goal is to break up, how do you do it? So it's things like getting really clear on why you're doing it, writing yourself a note so that later when you're less motivated, you remember why. It's telling a friend and having them hold you accountable. And you can even go so far as to say, if I don't break up with this person by this date, you know, I'm going to donate this check to this cause that I vehemently disagree with, or, you know, I won't get to go on this trip I'm looking forward to. Then it's practicing. What are you going to say? What's your opening? How are you going to tell them in a fair and honest way, but not giving them feedback? Because it's not about feedback in that moment. It's about saying, I don't want to be with you. You know, making sure that you have a plan of what you're going to do afterwards, so you don't slide back into the relationship. That if you were going on a trip with them, you cancel it. If you relied on them to help you with this work thing, you find a new mentor or something like that. And so really understanding that separating your life from someone is hard and you need to plan in advance so that you'll actually execute it, because the easiest path is always the path of least resistance. Keep doing what you're doing. And so you do need to make a conscious effort to do something different.
Yeah. I like all the little sort of the things that kind of like keep you honest, you know, telling a friend that you're going to do it and having a plan to follow up with them, only having a breakup conversation for a limited amount of time. So it doesn't last the whole fucking day, which I think that like we've all experienced. The problem that I see most of all, once you have that breakup conversation, sometimes or likely you've needed to have that conversation for a very long time.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden you're being incredibly honest with each other. And this feels like the most connecting conversation we've had in a year or something, right? So now all of a sudden these feelings are coming back and you're doubting yourself and you can't tell what's like, you know, the difference between up and down or left or right. And, what would you recommend to that person who's like all of a sudden like falling for the person all over again during a breakup conversation? Should they trust themselves?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's such a smart point. I really like the way you said it. I would almost use that information to inform how I coach them earlier. So I would say you're in a really disconnected place right now. Maybe I would start a little bit earlier and I would say, do they know how you're feeling?
Right.
And I would just get the answer. Yes, we talk about this all the time. I've consistently done this. We've done couples therapy. They're aware. Or no, they don't know. They think everything's great. Okay, well, in the scenario in which they don't know, then I might even say, kind of to your point, you're so disconnected right now that you haven't had that feeling of connection with them in a while. Can you try to recreate that connection and give them the feedback, not in a breakup, but to see when we reconnect, does it actually feel better and do we want to be in it? And mm-hmm. You could even use kind of the example you gave, which is it's possible that when you actually have this heart to heart, you're going to feel feelings for them that you haven't felt in a long time because you're connected. And I'd rather that you figure that out sooner and mm-hmm. try to make the relationship work than only be real with them for the first time in a year when you're breaking up with them. And so I think mm-hmm. using that insight that you said to encourage them to have the feedback conversation earlier, because I think it really is unfair when somebody's totally blindsided by a breakup. And I would say, if you're thinking about breaking up with someone, it's the right thing to do to give the other person a chance to either talk about what's going on or give feedback so that you're not in a situation where the first honest conversation you've had about it is one where you're ending the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's like something that I do that I'm not quite sure how much my partners actually enjoy this. But one of the things that I do sometimes is that when I define a relationship and it's like, all right, we're in this relationship and this is what we want, I immediately start having like a breakup conversation of like, how do you want to break up if we break mm-hmm. up? Do you want me to text you? Do you want me to call you? FaceTime yeah. in person? Do you want to be on a Thursday or Friday so you have the weekend to recover? Do you want to be in the morning, evening? Is there something that I should avoid? Like, give me all the information. And the reason I do that is so that like we can be as compassionate as possible if either of us decide to end a relationship. But usually the feedback I get is like, they're like, okay, if you ever want to break up with me, just fucking do it. Do not like stay yeah. in this relationship any longer than you should, knowing that you're going to end the relationship. Like it's a respect thing and it's a trust that you feel foolish being in a relationship with somebody that wants to get out of it and you don't know about that. But like you're saying, I think that like even before you do that or start questioning the relationship, go ahead and put everything on the table. Like try to create that really vulnerable, intimate conversation before you actually end things with them.
I think what you said is really smart, and it reminds me of some research that we did at Hinge. So I've thought for a long time about ghosting and just like, why do people ghost? And do people have a misconception around ghosting? And so what we did in this research at Hinge is saying to people, between all of these options, like, you know, what would you rather have? How would you like someone to break up with you, or would you rather be ghosted in? And they say, tell me, rejection hurts, but I'd rather know. That is overwhelmingly what people want. And then we say to people who ghost, many of whom are in the same category, why do you do it? And they say, oh, I don't want to hurt somebody's feelings. And so we perceive that being more avoidant or just ghosting or kind of the slow fade is more compassionate, but actually we're just avoiding the awkward conversation and just rejecting somebody outright is better. And so for you, you're kind of coming at it from like, of all the places that I can be compassionate with time of day and medium and this and that, what's the best way? And they're like, what I want is to just be rejected and have the information. Yeah. And so it's the same thing. It's like people are empowered when they know what they need to know about how someone feels about them. And yes, I do think that in person is better than phone and phone is better than text. And I think there's absolutely a right way to break up with someone, but I like the point that you're making, which is just what people want is to know from the beginning how you feel about them.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have any, like if somebody goes out with somebody for maybe like 5 dates and they want to end the dating, would you recommend some, and you say like, okay, hey, I'm not feeling the connection, the romantic connection that I want. I don't want to go on another date with you. And then they say like, can you tell me why? Why is it that you don't feel the connection? Would you recommend that person be really honest about like, well, it's the way that you, you know, I don't like your laugh, or I think that like your style isn't like a good complement of my style. Like if it's something sort of like surface level, do you tell them about that? Or do you just sort of like stay vague? It's like, you know, it's just the connection.
That one's really hard. I would say over the years, having had my clients experiment with different things, a lot of times people don't respond well to the feedback and it actually makes the person feel uncomfortable for saying it in the first place. And so I would say in general, I would just keep it vague and say, you know, I didn't feel a connection, or at this point in time, I would expect to feel more than I feel right now. So I think in general, it has felt safer for the person breaking up with them to just be a little bit more vague. And what I mean by safe is like, sometimes people can strike back and say something mean to you. And I just don't want my clients mm-hmm. to be in that position. I also think in general, there's feedback that somebody can act on or not. Like the example you gave about your laugh, it's like, no one can change their laugh. So like hearing right. that just feels cruel. Mm-hmm. You might think about a situation where somebody made a joke that was offensive to you, or somebody was really inconsistent in their messaging. And maybe you do want to give feedback on that and say, hey, I really enjoyed spending time with you in person, but your DBL, your digital body language, was really hard to read. And I found that I never was sure when we were hanging out, or I just wasn't sure how you felt about me. And then maybe mm-hmm. that person says, oh, thanks for letting me know. I actually am really interested. Can we give it another try? But I would say, unfortunately, giving feedback often is a risk, and especially feedback that the person can't change isn't helpful. So mm-hmm. the general advice I give is to be more vague, but if somebody feels strongly like this person did this thing that's consistently a turnoff, they should know about it. For example, my friend was told, like, I was really interested in you. Then I saw your bathroom and it was like filthy with a dirty toilet and overflowing garbage can. And I knew that you weren't ready to be in a relationship. Like, that happened to my friend, and he did get his shit together more, and he found that advice helpful. So I would say mm-hmm. if you feel bold enough to give feedback, especially feedback that someone can take action on, then you're doing that person potentially a favor, but also know that you're exposing yourself to potentially a conversation that you don't want to have where you're getting unsolicited feedback. Like, I also think it's fine to just say, I didn't feel a connection.
Yeah. Yeah. You could be doing them a solid, being like, this is something that has unattracted, maybe other people would be unattracted yeah. to this specific thing. And you're also being kind if you're like not telling them specifically what you don't like that they can't yeah. actually change.
What yeah. do you do? What do you recommend?
I recommend being really vague at okay. first, and then if they ask for feedback, go ahead and continue to give like some vague feedback. Mm-hmm. If they continue to ask though, then I would say like, ask for consent first. So like, okay, I'll give you feedback about the specific thing that I don't like, understanding that like, I don't know you very well at all. So it could just be me projecting some bullshit right, onto absolutely. You. That's my own personal shit that I need to work on. But I'll tell you the thing that turned me off, if you actually want to hear that. So think about that for a bit and then come back to me and I'll let you know. And then even so, like, it's not, you can still say no, you can still say vague, you can still stay vague. It's not your responsibility to like give them that feedback. So like you're saying, it's a risk, because then you're like opening things up. They might be reactive.
Yeah. I'm almost thinking about it as a flow chart or something where it's like, is this feedback that they can take action on? Like, if no, then don't move forward. If it is feedback they can take action on, do mm-hmm. you think this is the kind of person who's open to it? Do you think that they would, are you the right person to give it to them? And kind of thinking through that. And like, I'm sure there are scenarios where it's like, you know, I really liked you, but I just got the impression that dating isn't a priority to you right now. And I want to date someone who dating is a priority to you. And they might say, it actually is. Can I have another chance? Or they might say, yes, you picked on that correctly. Or maybe they just know for the future that they're giving off that vibe. But it's basically like the cliche is like feedback is a gift, but maybe I would also add like feedback is a risk, because you don't mm-hmm. know how that person's going to respond. And five dates isn't really knowing someone that well. And so Do you feel comfortable now being in a more vulnerable situation with that person where they could strike back or mm-hmm. say something mean? And like, I generally want people to keep dating. And if having that conversation is going to hurt them and take them out of the dating pool, I almost would rather protect them in that moment.
Yeah, I would too. Last question to wrap things up. Since this podcast is called Big Dating Energy, what do you think? What's your definition of big dating energy?
Yeah, I love this. I mean, amazing title, and very excited for your book.
Thank you.
What would be, I think big dating energy is somebody who exists in the world with an abundance mindset, where they feel like, I am awesome. I would be an awesome partner. Somebody would be lucky to be with me. And I am going to put myself out there knowing that if somebody's not interested in me, then we're not the right match. It's not a reflection of who I am. And I meet people. When I meet people, I connect with them. People feel drawn to me. I feel drawn to them. I'm open to connection. I'm open to sexual attraction. I'm open to vulnerability. And it's really coming from this sense of, I am wonderful. Somebody would be lucky to be with me. I don't operate from a scarcity mindset of I'm too old. I'm not good enough. There's not enough good partners out there, but truly that I am here to interact with different people and see what comes of it. And I am confident that I'm going to find the right person because I am the right person.
I'm going to make that my subtitle on my book.
Okay, in a really small font.
Yeah. I think that's a really perfect definition of what big dating energy. Do you think that you know any like public figures or celebrities that maybe could possibly like have that type of energy?
Well, I mean, I feel like you're like obviously BDE has like some Pete Davidson vibes.
Sure.
Is that what you're trying to get me to say?
No. I mean, Pete Davidson actually recently has decided to stop dating for a little bit.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Which I think is a good idea. He's just sort of like going inward and asking himself some questions about what he's looking
for. How do you know that?
Oh, there was like an article a month ago about it. And I also think that like, big dick energy is different than big dating energy.
Yeah.
Although I'm sure there's an overlap in the Venn diagram.
Celebrity stuff is hard because they are living on a different planet. They're so beautiful. They're so famous. I really have no idea what it's like to be a celebrity. And I also feel so removed from their world that I'm like, I have no idea what Drew Barrymore's life is like, right? Like she's so far from me, but I definitely know everyday people that I think have big dating energy and I feel drawn to them and happy for them.
Yeah. I think it might be, I don't know. It might be tricky for like those celebrities to have that sort of like big dating energy because their whole life is so loaded and put under a microscope and
Yeah. Was there a celebrity that you were thinking about?
I don't know. Sometimes I think about like, wish or hope that maybe George Clooney had big dating energy when he was dating, or like maybe like a Lizzo or Jennifer Lawrence has like big dating energy, I would imagine. Yeah. Taylor Swift maybe even. Like I think that she has got like a great vibe. And
I think it's complicated because I just quickly go to like, they're so beautiful. They're so rich. Like what's their dating life like? Which honestly isn't fair because I've worked with plenty of clients that are both of those things or one of those things. I think it's almost like it's really hard to know what somebody's dating life is like because there are so many complicated psychological factors that are just not being published in Us Weekly.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. It was really good having you on this podcast.
Yeah,
you're so,
fun. So
easy to talk to.
And you're so easy to talk to. The time flew by. I'm so glad you're doing the show. I'm so glad you're putting stuff out there. I'm glad you're raising the bar for everyone. And just excited to support you and for the book. And more conversations to come.
Can you tell people where they can find you?
Sure. Yeah. People can follow me on Instagram at Logan Urey. I send out a weekly dating newsletter called Logan's Love Letter. People can sign up for that on my website. And if they're interested in taking my quiz, they can go to loganurey.com/quiz and find out their dating tendency.
Yes. And buy her book. It is amazing. It's a really quick and easy read that just gives you like a ton of good information to make dating easier. So highly recommend. 10 out of 10.
I appreciate it. Great.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we did it.